Hello and welcome to All About Symbian Insight number 62. If I'm sounding a bit croaky, it's because I'm a bit under the weather, but Rafe is in good spirits. See you there, Rafe?
I am, Steve.
Yeah, Ewan should be joining us at some point. He's been called away, so we'll see if he arrives. In the meantime, I've got plenty of questions and things to chat about. Let's start with the full S65th edition SDK is now available, version 1.0. The reason that's significant from a non-developer point of view, I remember Rafe on the old days, in days of Scion, there's the mention, and we used to have the emulator would be bundled in with the SDK, with the programming kit, so that you could effectively have a virtual emulated device running within Windows on your PC. Is that still the case here?
Yes, that is still the case. The SDK includes all the sort of documentations and various developer tools and information on the APIs and everything you need to program a device. And as part of that, it includes an emulator version, which means effectively, yes, you do get a version of S60 running inside a window on the PC. There are some differences because of the hardware architecture. Actually, from a developer point of view, it means you have to compile programs differently, and just as you did in the Scion days, actually. It's not quite a sort of a copy, if you like, because it's basically the very basic version of S60, or I should say the default version of S60. Typically with the phones, we get a lot of customization from the likes of Nokia, and the same thing from Samsung, and in the future Sony Ericsson. So some of the things will be missing, so you won't necessarily have something like the contact bar from the 5800 or the widget home screen from the N97, although that may come in due course, probably via an SDK plugin. But in terms of things like the contacts application, the web browser, and you know, the other sort of core applications, if you like, they run exactly as you would imagine. And if you know you haven't tried out S65th edition, you know, on a hardware piece of device and want to try it, you know, the emulator, I guess, is one way to go. But of course, the main significance here is for developers. You know, version 1 is available. Previously, it was version 0.9, almost a beta, if you like. And so this sort of signals the maturity of the 5th edition platform from a developer story. You know, you can use it to develop with C++, that's Symbian C++, and OpenC and OpenC++, that's effectively writing as you would for something like the Linux platform, but on Symbian. Then, of course, there's Java with GME, web runtime, using web technologies, and there's a SDK plugin for Python and some of the other runtime languages. And, of course, it's also usable for testing flashlight content, as it would be seen on the device, although in that particular case, there are better standalone tools for Flash.
Yeah, one word of warning to people who are planning on trying this is that I think it's a fairly hefty download, and not only that, but it also expands to a pretty humongous size on your hard disk. So if you want to just play with the 5800, go and play with one in a shop.
Yeah, I'd definitely say that's right. And also the emulator itself needs a fair bit of oomph to run it. Things have improved in this version. They've actually included a sort of a progress or a status bar indicating how long you've got to go when you're starting up the emulator. Previously, I can remember waiting several minutes for the emulator to start. You know, so far worse performance than you actually get on the phone itself.
Yeah, one interesting anecdote about these emulators, part of SDKs, is that they have a whole lease of life that the developers of the SDK never intended, right at the end of a platform's existence. So in 5 or 6 years' time, in this case, when the Nokia 5800 and N97 are old and obsolete and in the grave, people will still be able to look at what they play with, how they look like, and perhaps run software. And ideas and concepts that were used in this year, 2009, in 2014, by running up the emulator. And I know this is how it works, because I'm still getting requests to do things on the Scion platform to try things out and to open Scion files and convert them. And this is 10 years after that platform died. And the only way I've got of handling these files, trying out these functions and trying these programs, is using a virtual Scion on my PC. I sold my last bit of Scion hardware about 4 or 5 years ago. So these emulators, they have this really useful life at the start of a platform's existence where people are developing software. And they also have this weird extended afterlife as well, but maybe that's just me.
Well, I know I can see the case for that. And I know people have certainly used it to access their contacts database from their phone, you know, if they've lost the phone and don't move to S60 but need to get at the information. There's several instructions around the web on how to do that sort of thing. So presumably be just as applicable for the new S60 5th edition SDK.
Yeah, So these are so whenever you see All About Symbian mentioning an SDK, and don't just write it off as programmers only, because there is a window of opportunity and usability there for general users, for emergencies, and for things that might happen in a couple of years' time if you want to rescue lost data.
I think that's right. I'll just say one more thing about it, and that is that the Symbian Foundation platform, which will be coming out in the second half of this year, so the first release under the auspices of the Foundation as opposed to Symbian Limited, is going to be very heavily based on this S65th edition. It's probably no surprise that, given that it's going to be happening within a few months, it will be very, very similar to this this particular release of the SDK. Indeed, I think probably the most accurate way to describe the Symbian Foundation platform was really S65th edition feature pack 1, and it's going to add in some elements from MOAP. That will be an optional pack that sits on top of the SDK. At the moment, those are sort of known as operator licensing packs, and they sort of customize it. And actually, you get the same thing for things like Vodafone and T-Mobile, but in the case, of course, of MOAP, it's for the Japanese carrier NTT Docomo, and is far more extensive. But the point I wanted to make really was, for developers, if you want to develop to the Symbian Foundation platform for the Samsung, Sony Ericsson, Nokia, and perhaps other devices, this is the SDK you want to be looking at, and you can start right now.
Yes, let's just move on slightly, Rafe. We've got an article on the site from last week, which many people found very interesting. You were talking about your experiences of the Nokia N97 at MWC, about widgets, but also specifically about kinetic scrolling in the web browser. Now, I've discovered something very interesting. On the 5800, if people want to just try this on their devices while they're listening to this, load up a modest-sized web page, in this case, the All About Symbian front page, and if I now wait for it to load, and then finger flick it up or down, as I take my finger off at the end of the flick, it does carry on moving. There are two or three extra stages, only 5 or 10 pixels each, while the page comes to a stop. I think that kinetic scrolling has been there all the time in the web browser, in S65th edition, but it's obviously been dramatically changed in terms of its parameters and optimization, so that on the N97 it's much more dramatic and much more usable. So I think that the 5800 is liable to get the same changes as the N97 in its next firmware, as it gets these new parameters and new settings. Do you think that's likely, Rafe?
Yes, I do, Steve. I mean, going back to sort of adding things into the 5800, that's a sort of firmware decision, but it's entirely possible that it could happen. The 5800 doesn't really have true kinetic scrolling in the sense it won't keep on going, but it's something that is easily added in terms of there's nothing stopping it in the hardware. And according to the people I spoke to, the N97's kinetic scrolling was added by the browser team out of Boston, so it was being added to the browser application itself, not something specific to the N97. I think it's probably worth emphasizing the difference that kinetic scrolling makes. What happens is, as you say, you touch the screen and it moves the page, and then you tap it again to stop it, which avoids the having to move your finger across the page lots of times to scroll about, or indeed with similar thing with the D-pad. And I think this is the reason that the browsing experience on something like the Apple iPhone or the T-Mobile G1 gets so many plaudits. I mean, yes, there's some things around the capacitive screen and the large screen size, but it makes it a lot easier to move about a web page. And to my mind, at least, it sort of solved the problem of being on the slightly smaller screen device. And I tried it on the N97, albeit only for a few minutes, but it made an enormous difference. And sort of that, along with the widgets, it was very interesting for me because it changed my feelings about the N97. You know, I'd seen it at Nokia World, and the hardware was great, but the software really wasn't finished. But seeing it at MWC so much further on, and the software was also more stable, and as I mentioned in the article, the widgets were more complete. But it really brings home to you how important software is to the overall experience. And there's still, you know, 3 or 4 months to go before the N97 comes out. So it'll be interesting to see what else gets added. But for my money, you know, that's probably the single most important thing that could have been done to the web browser. So I was really impressed. And it'll be interesting to see people's reaction to the N97 as a browsing device now that it's got that, well, you know, one small piece of functionality. I mean, I say it's small from an engineering point of view. It's not trivial to add. But yes, as I say, I do think it's quite significant.
Yeah, thanks, Rafe. Opera software have released a thing called Finger Touch for their web browser for UIQ. So we're talking, they really must love UIQ over there, probably for national reasons. And Finger Touch, if I describe it briefly, is a way of the touch software, the touch layer, knowing which hyperlinks and which fields your finger is over, and then expanding them on screen so that you can pick them more easily. Now, I have to say, I watched the demo video of this running on a UIQ emulator, I think, and I wasn't that impressed. It's a nice idea, and it's well done, but the double tap, for example, in the S60 5th edition web browser to zoom right in, surely that does the same job, and just as intuitively, without having an extra layer of software or having to go to a specific web browser. Rafe, what's your thoughts on Finger Touch?
Well, obviously, you have to wait until you see it in a real device. In terms of being on UIQ, I suspect that's just the platform that Opera have sort of been using for doing their test development on Symbian. Having spoken to them at MWC, they are expecting to release a version for S60 in due course. But I was quite caught by this, because I think there's plenty of innovation for sort of software in the browser space for overcoming the shortcomings of mobile device, and Opera's already done that with Opera Mini in terms of how much bandwidth you have and how quickly a page downloads. But on touch devices, you know, pressing the wrong link is a problem. And yes, you're right, Steve, you know, you can zoom in and then click on the right link and then zoom back out again. Using the Finger Touch, you really cut out two of those steps, because you touch it once and it sort of does the zoom in for you. You touch it again to select the right element, and that's it, you're done. So rather than having to zoom in, which may be a two-stage process, select the right link and then zoom back out again. So I just think it, you know, it cuts out some of the interaction steps. And, you know, when you're doing things like, filling in a form in a browser, that, you know, it's nice to have that kind of thing, you know, the shortcut. So it's just one example of sort of innovation. And Opera have been very good at this over the years. But I have to say, I wouldn't be surprised to see this, you know, taken on board by some of the other browsers, just in the way that, you know, Tabs was popularized by, you know, some of the earlier browsers, and since, you know, is now a universal thing on the desktop. Because having tried mobile browsers a lot on touchscreen devices, particularly on the smaller ones, and I'm thinking, you know, the G700 and the G900 UIQ devices here, but even on something like the 5800 on the iPhone, which have much bigger screens, you know, I've definitely experienced that problem of not getting the right thing. So I'd be a little more optimistic about it than you, Steve, perhaps.
Okay, Ewan, have you tried the Finger Touch or seen the demo?
I have seen the demo. I have to say, I've not actually tried it on any of the Opera browsers. But having experienced the whole, you know, let's use a great big clumpy finger as a pointer on other mobile devices, as we've already mentioned, our Android and the iPhone are the obvious ones. This is actually, I think, a necessary function. The demise of the pointer, or the stylus, depending on which sort of nomenclature you want to use, is probably one that we should look at in the near future. But as more and more people only use fingers and don't have lovely manicured big pointy nails, then, you know, it's all great having great big pixel density on your screen, but when you start using large fonts, you know, you've either got to zoom in, which is the solution on the iPhone, or come up with, are you sure you want to go for that one? Opera have went for the latter implementation. From what I've seen, it's very slick. It's obviously going to slow down the browsing experience on one hand and speed it up on another. I think it really needs an extensive test. And I think bottom line is, it's going to come down to what people are used to. If they get a device with Finger Touch, they'll moan for a week and then they'll be fine with it. And then they'll have to switch to one that doesn't, in which case it's the best thing since sliced bread. Or they're just so set in their ways with an existing browser that they're just never going to be able to accept any sort of new feature.
I think we'll have to wait and see how this one pans out, and also wait for Finger Touch to hit S60 and perhaps the current mainstream. As Ewan's now here, you've gathered from
Hello.
His Scottish tones. Yes, he's joined us from Edinburgh. So I know he's been trying out this new N-Gage game, Monopoly, Here and Now World Edition. So what's it like, Ewan? 90-second review?
There's no Mayfair! I think one of the great things about Monopoly is, and certainly in British households, is you can look at it and you know that Old Kent Road is worth more than Mayfair. The Strand's kind of in the middle. Now you have to work out if New York is worth more than Tokyo, because the names have changed to internationalize it. Given the strength and focus that Nokia have in location, I'd love to see that this automatically switch over to your own region. So if you're in the UK, you get Mayfair as the top property. If you're in New York, then you'll get Madison Square Gardens or Park Lane or whichever one they have over there. In short, this is another title from Electronic Arts. They've previously had a version out of this on mobile, on standard handsets, so I suspect it's Java. This is in the same way that DChalk have upgraded Solitaire and Sudoku to the Engage system. EA have done the same here with their version of Monopoly. It means that it's missing a couple of things, and the obvious one is multiplayer. This would seem to be a good game. It's turn-based. It doesn't require lightning reactions for a multiplayer experience, either local or wide area, and it doesn't have it. And I think that's the great big missing feature. What is nice, though, is the AI on board. I think that when you actually hand yourself a game with yourself, an incredibly smart computer AI and two dumb computer AIs, you actually get a very challenging game of Monopoly. And I know a lot of people go, Monopoly is all about luck and skill, about luck and no skill. But there is elements of skill here. The only thing is, it's very hard to bluff your opponents in this game. It's nice. It doesn't really stretch the Engage platform to any extent. And to a certain extent, that's the same with Electronic Arts titles over any platform. They'll do just enough to be different from the last version and make you to buy it again. And that's what you have here. This could have been a brilliant Engage game if there was more time spent on it, but I think Electronic Arts made decisions, we'll do enough to get it in the system and then work on something else. Go for volume instead of one standout title. It is a well-deserved download. I don't see why anybody should not try the demo. Be aware there are some failings in it. But other than that, on balance, this is a game that's a lot more thumbs up than thumbs down for me. It gets a top hat and a silver doggy for me.
I have to say that I'm surprised about the lack of multiplayer, because I've been trying, as part of with my iPhone hat on, doing some iPhone reviews, and I reviewed the iPhone version of Electronic Arts Monopoly Here and Now World Edition, and it is stonkingly good. I think I had to say it's the best implemented mobile game I've ever seen in my life. Everything about it is perfect, from the animations to the texturing to the gameplay to the cut screens to the Wi-Fi four-way multiplayer. It's stonkingly good, and I was slightly disappointed to hear that they've cut a few corners for the Engage version, because on other platforms, EA have shown they can go all the way and produce something that's really good. Unfortunately, this is kind of a recurring theme on some of the Engage titles, that it does seem as though companies are just putting in just enough effort to get the Engage certification and get onto the platform. I really hope they can produce a new version and make Monopoly even better on Engage.
I think part of it is because the iPhone is now seen as the current sexy device, and therefore there's a little bit more at stake, whereas the N-Gage it's a mobile phone plus, whereas the iPhone is seen as a mobile computer by these companies. And certainly EA have made lots of nice noises about Apple system, and have in the last couple of months made some rather not too discreet, what's going on there, noises at Nokia. So EA are obviously committed in the long term, but I think they just see the N-Gage as the delivery system for phone games with extras, as opposed to a clearly defined and different platform that I suspect that they view the iPhone as.
I think that's right, Euron. I mean, the thing is about a lot of the third-party games coming onto Engage is they're little more than Java ports in one sense. You know, the Java ports have been out there on operator decks, and they're coming onto Engage because it's another distribution platform. It's not another gaming platform in the sense there's, you know, innovation they can do with it. And it's rather a chicken and egg situation, I feel. You know, while there's still these games coming out, Engage will do fine, but to really break out, it probably needs to offer a little more than just being sort of a channel. From a consumer point of view, that yes, it's great having a channel, but why would you choose the Engage version over another version? Of course, the answer to that at the moment is that it's easy to get it onto your device, and all the payment and the community stuff is integrated. But I feel to really sort of break out, you probably need to do more than that. And Nokia have been doing that with their first-party titles and will no doubt continue to do so. So, I just putting my oar in, I just think it's a slightly chicken-and-egg situation with third-party games. I don't, you know, is it a bad, doesn't mean Engage is going to fail? No, because obviously there's still time to go on that. But clearly it does open Engage up to a certain amount of criticism, especially when you're doing the direct comparison with something like the iPhone or the DS Lite. But, I mean, as we've said in the past, perhaps that's an unfair comparison because we're talking about, you know, a different scale and we're talking about a different type of gaming experience. So just a bit of food for thought there.
And of course, the iPhone version is actually cheaper as well, but maybe I'm being a bit cruel in mentioning
that. Yeah, let's kick Engage while it's down. I mean, yes, there's all sorts of interesting...
It's never got up, really, has it?
Well, okay, let's tread on its grave then and sort of just, you know, pile on with everyone else. Yeah, I mean, the iPhone pricing thing is something I think we should get into on another podcast, because it'll certainly start having relevance with the BlackBerry store and, you know, the Ovi store coming up in due course. But yes, again, it's an important factor. You know, pricing at the end of the day is probably the single most important thing, reason that people buy stuff or don't buy stuff. And it doesn't get enough attention, you know, full stop, really, as he gets off his, yeah, don't get me going on pricing.
Okay, one thing I wanted to address in this podcast, I wrote an article on the site last week talking about the 5800's home screen and a couple of cool things to think about. And we got a bit of flack in the comments, people saying, why are they all about Symbian bothering to write these things? Surely this stuff's in the manual. It may well be in the manual. Two points, though. I haven't got a manual because my 5800 was so early, it came with everything but the manual. I know there's a PDF on the web, but the main things I wanted to get across were things like strategic points. For example, you only get four application shortcuts, and there are so many built-in shortcuts that are not obvious. There's no point, for example, in putting a shortcut to clock or a shortcut to calendar or a shortcut to one of the connectivity options or a shortcut to profiles as one of the four main used applications, because those are already ready available by tapping on other bits of the home screen. That's the main point I wanted to get across, that you could think out of the box because you had another dozen or so shortcuts already built into this touch screen in front of you, and there's no point in duplicating it. With a bit of thought, you can get to the point where you can do everything you want to do on the smartphone, more or less, just from the one home screen without even delving into the S60 menu. So I kind of felt a bit misunderstood there. Also, I was talking about the addition of feeds to the contact bar on the 5800 home screen, and I still don't think that's very obvious and how to do it. So I just wanted to walk through the steps 1, 2, and 3 of how to get your favorite contacts feeds on that home screen. I'm sure it'll be useful to someone, and if nothing else, people will find it via Google. So there we are. I've got that off my chest.
I think it's worth pointing out as well that one of the things about, we're doing on All About Symbian at the moment is trying to broaden the appeal beyond the, you know, very strong tech audience, which we hopefully have now. And we've actually had quite a lot of positive feedback on some of the more basic tutorials we've done, with people going, you know, it's fantastic, you've taught me how to use this, because let's face it, no one reads the manual anyway, and sometimes you need to have it pointed out in a more obvious way to you. But we do value people's feedback on that sort of thing. But there is a balance to be struck here, and we'd be interested to hear people's views on how they think we should do it, which is, you know, how do we combine having our continued sort of coverage focused on the high-end users who are particularly interested in some of the technical details and want to go into real depth on in terms of how the devices are put together and some of the interesting points about them, while also appealing to a more general audience. And there's some implicit questions in how we put our content together and how we lay out the site. So that is sort of on the cards, and we're thinking quite a lot about that at the moment. So that probably plays into, you know, some of the feedback that Steve got there, and I'd be interested to hear people's views.
Okay, well, so do comment away by email to the usual addresses. Ewan has been planning his trip across America over the next 3 weeks. He'll probably be gone by the time you listen to this, or certainly heading towards a plane. He's taking with him the Nokia 5800, among other gadgets, and he's going to report on his first steps with S60 5th edition and touch. But an interesting point, we were trying to get a...
Sounds like it's going well, then.
I thought it was broken when I got it, because it's got the resonance tap whenever you do a point or tap on the screen, and every time I tapped the screen I just felt, why is it wobbling? And it's not, it's the resistive feedback pretendy thing. So I switched that off once I realized that I hadn't broken it. First impressions was it's broken, and I've fixed it. I am a god. Hey. But interesting, yes.
You don't like the haptic feedback, Ewan?
Nope, turned it off.
That's interesting. See, that's one of the things I like most about the device compared to some of the other touchscreen devices, you know, because I like that feeling of knowing I pressed a button on screen.
I just, there's enough feedback with flashes and lights and cursors. It just, it made the device feel less secure in my hand. Now it's turned off. It's good, it's robust, it's small, it's nice physical size. With the haptic feedback turned on, I just felt the thing was wobbling all the time. I mean, obviously it's not. I could see it's not. But the feeling in my hand was it was rocking away from me, towards me, and it just made the device feel really squidgy. That is obviously a correct review term. So yes, bye-bye haptic feedback. Hello, nice, secure, soft-feeling, solid 5800.
I think it'll be interesting to see whether Ewan turns that back on in a week or two's time after he's tried typing on the blessed thing. Anyway, the whole point of this little segment on the podcast, I wanted to draw attention to video recording on smartphones. And the reason I say that is Ewan's planning to do a little video diary of his experiences, A, going around America with the 5800, and B, how he gets on with the device itself and the different aspects of the software and hardware. Tell the listeners how we started testing to do this trial video, Ewan.
Well, we'd already decided that I would take as much raw footage as possible, send that back to Orbit Symbiote, where it'd be polished and topped and tailed, and naughty words would be taken out, and we'd have Indiana Jones flying maps going off in the background with some stirring soundtracks. But of course, to record what I'm doing on the 5800, can't really use the 5800 because you wouldn't see it then. So I had to grab another device, and the plan had always been, initially the plan had been to use an N86, but then Stephen Ray pointed out how brilliant I am at taking pictures, and can they not have it instead? So I went, oh, that's okay, I've got an N85 here. That's nice, it's new, we can rack that up, we can take the video on that. And I have to say, and the video recording on the N85 was poor, is the best description, Steve?
Yes.
Underpowered, useless, below par. It just failed.
Quantitatively, what was wrong, and I think this is wrong with the N79, the N85 and the N96, is that there are performance issues and there's also focusing issues. And Ewan also sent me over a video he produced on the Flip, a sort of a consumer video device, which was 100
times my Fisher Price first video cam. Yes,
that's the one. So, and I was quite surprised by how poor the N85 was. And there's the two problems. One is that the N85 and N79 are seemingly focused. The focus in video mode seems to be at infinity. So, but why would you, unless you're actually videoing landscapes all the time, why you'd want to do that? Most of the time you're videoing people and subjects and interesting things which are close by. And the second problem is that the N85 video was dropping frames right, left, and centre. So you've got very jerky playback, and I suspect that's down to, you know, performance problems within the firmware, within the processor, within the disk subsystems. So on a hunch, Ewan switched to his trusty N95. Ewan, didn't you?
Indeed, well, it's N95 8 gig, let's be honest here. And I've used this before, and I've had problems with getting proper video editing done on my PC, and I've always blamed the N95. It was one of the early ones, and we'd always talked about the speed of writing to the internal disk and assumed that. But lo and behold, when we actually did the proper tests on that and uploaded the video file, exactly the same conditions, same quality rating, putting up at VGA, max quality, video stabilization off, sound recording on. The footage that comes out of that is usable, clear, focused, which for me taking pictures was a revelation to everybody else at All About Symbian, and actually usable. So Nokia's flagship from 2 years ago stomps all over what they would supply for this year, what's available on the market right now. And given that they've always said we've got Carl Zeiss lens, we've got such a great focus in video and media and pictures, yeah, sure, they take great pictures, guys, but to use video, it's like, I don't see why anybody would use video in anger on the N85 or any of the modern devices now.
Yeah, I think it's just it's stunning how bad the video is on some of these devices, given that it should be a year more advanced than the N95. And yes, there is the absence of graphics acceleration, but I'm not entirely sure that's that's to blame here. I think this is perhaps something different. The N96 has extra video encoding and decoding hardware, so I think the N96 would have produced slightly smoother video, but there's still the focus problem. And so, yes, when Ewan showed me his N95 shot video, and I shoot my smartphone show on the N93 and the N82, both
which
also,
is even older. Even
older, yeah. And they're relatively crystal clear, with no problems whatsoever in terms of frame rate or focusing. So I have to say that the 5800 itself, given good light conditions, shoots excellent video, and that hasn't got the N95-style chipset. So Nokia can do it, but I think this whole generation, this whole 2008 line of handsets, which have very disappointing video performance. And no matter, they may still call it DVD quality. People may think, well, it'll have the same video recording quality as my old N95 then. But it doesn't. It's much, much worse. And I'm drawing a line in the sand here and saying, telling it like it is. It's not as good as I would like. Rafe, have you got any comments on this tale of woe?
Yes, I have. I think this is an interesting one. It's not the first time someone's made this observation to me. And you talked about the focusing. And I think actually you're probably spot on when you're talking about talking head type video. But I wonder how much of that is actually, when we're talking about in the consumer market, how many people actually do that kind of thing? Clearly there's, scopes for bloggers and journalists doing that kind of thing. But the average person, what are they shooting? Well, they're probably shooting a family playing outside or some footballing event where the distances involved tend to be greater, and therefore the sort of the infinite focus results in better video. I mean, clearly there are some hardware issues as well. The other thing that I know creeps up as a problem sometime is that the included memory cards aren't always up to it in speed terms for recording the very highest quality video. So
I've got to come back at that point there, because even putting aside the focus issue, which to a non-photo techie to me is just leaves me lost, you still have the frame drop issue. You still have it stuttering, and that it doesn't matter how far away what you're recording is, you're still going to have that problem if it's jerky and it's almost like somebody's hand spooling a film. Well, what is the problem in having a consistent 25 frames per second being saved to disk? That was the big letdown for me.
Yes, and that's a perfectly fair point. Without sort of looking at it in great detail, yes, there is a hardware difference, as you're probably aware. It's dual processor as opposed to single processor, so you probably have to be more careful about what tasks you might be running in the background when doing prolonged bit of video. I don't know.
We covered that, Rafe. Just to interrupt there, Ray, Ewan and I were very careful when I made him close down everything, make sure all third parties.
The device was reset, holding down the pencil key. There was nothing else running.
Well, there you go then. So, I mean, that does go to prove your point. I suspect it's maybe to do with the fact that the hardware platform has changed, and the sort of the compromises in the software are sort of evaluated slightly differently, maybe on the basis that video is used less. I don't know. Would have to look into that in more detail, and maybe we'll do that for a future podcast. I would maintain my point about the focusing for distances, and the interesting thing with video on these devices is I still think it's a lot better than what you get on pretty much any other cell phone, and it's a good enough thing coming in. But this is clearly going to be a question of the future, and we're seeing the HD video on the Samsung Omnia, and I think video is becoming more and more important. It's not just a sort of a fairly niche thing in terms of uploading content to YouTube, or as Ewan does, some sort of video blogging. This thing is only going to get more popular, so it's clearly something that Nokia is going to need to address in the future. And so there we go. Some practical input from both Ewan and Steve there. I can't say I use video all that much on my devices, but it's interesting that you had so many problems. And just goes to show all the work we have to do to bring you good content on All About Symbian.
I'm sorry. You talked about the video being good enough, and I guess that's from some Nokia product manager's point of view. But good enough is not good enough, in my opinion.
And dropping frames rate isn't good enough. Dropping frames rate is game over.
Yeah. Given Nokia's the marketing angle of these phones and the reputation of the N series and all the hard work put in by the N95 and the N95 8GB. To have the performance drop so drastically for the successors just seems ridiculous, and I'm thoroughly looking forward to the N97. I think that may well be a true next gen device after things like the N95 and N82. I'm just going to miss out this current 2008 lineup. I'm sorry, in this particular department it's a complete write off. Comments are welcome from listeners on what you shoot video of. Do you shoot close up stuff, or do you shoot stuff that's far away? Is the focusing a problem for you if you own an N79, an N85, or an N96? We'd very much like to know and get some more data points and all this. Also, we got comments from Ewan and myself on how to edit your smartphone short video successfully, and we've tried all sorts of solutions, and we've got a few answers, but we're going to leave that for another podcast because we're coming up on time now. So unless you guys have got anything else, I'll say goodbye. It's from me, Steve Litchfield.
And goodbye from me, Rafe Blanford.
And goodbye from me, Ewan Spence. Now, where's my passport?
Bye, Ewan. Safe trip.